are back again. Welcome, everybody. Hope you're doing well. This is Henrik. We had a few days break here as we were getting back and getting going again after the Electric Universe Conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico this past weekend. It was great seeing all of you there who decided to drop by and connected with some folks and new researchers there. So good stuff. Today we're talking with Patrick Henningsen. He's an independent journalist currently based in London. He is the managing editor of 21st Century Wire, an independent media voice for geopolitical news and analysis, working with an array of contributors, aggregating news and opinion from around the world. We are going to get an update on the situation in Ukraine and Crimea today. We're going to talk about Western and Russian relations, and there is much to churn out, so we'll get started right away. Patrick Henningsen, thank you for coming back again on Red Ice Radio. It's always a pleasure speaking with you. It's always great to have you on, a great analyst from over at 21stCenturyWire.com. How are you today, Patrick?
Very well, Henrik. Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
You bet. This is just an incredible story. We've been trying to get you on, of course, before this, just because to cover a little bit on the Ukraine situation, but we are here today to do that. And I'm just amazed at how long this conflict has been going on so far without, dare I say, then breaking out into something that is more serious than it is at this point. And I'm not trying to downplay it or anything like that. But, you know, we know about the illegal Western-backed coup in Kiev, and it has not been going too well for them either. So how do you think that we should interpret what has been going on in Ukraine up to this point? I think that, you know, most people in this field who listen to this kind of program are by default kind of vehemently anti the Western media per se. But is it a mistake to jump on the, you know, go Putin bandwagon? Or how do you interpret all of this?
I've said from the beginning, even as far back as December, I kind of saw the writing on the wall. And you could, you know, if you follow these types of events and you've followed color revolutions that have happened not just in the Ukraine, but in Georgia, and of course, right through the Arab Spring. And then also going back and looking at the Balkans war with Serbia, Kosovo, the breakup of Yugoslavia, and you take a historical perspective and you tend not to want to jump to conclusions. At the end of the day, in the West, the media will try to dictate the conversation and try to dictate the pace, and then politicians will normally follow suit. Those two organizations, mainstream corporate media and our political leadership, sadly, are pretty much synchronized when it comes to how these issues break and how they're disseminated in the public. So early on, I looked at this and I said, well, you know, if 50 or 60 years of Cold War taught me anything, it's that there will be no shooting war between Russia, Europe, and America.
Right.
It's not going to happen. But what I did see, and quite predictably, of course, is that this is a lot deeper than just what's happening in the Ukraine and even Crimea. And now we're seeing the statements coming out in the press. I knew when there was a little bit of a wrangle over the U.S. defense budget in January, Chuck Hagel was sort of defending his corner. And, you know, the U.S. is essentially, I think everybody can accept that, you know, from a balance sheet perspective, the United States is bankrupt and has been, and even Washington having to admit that with the sequestering and shutdown of the government back in October, the United States is bankrupt. And what is the biggest ticket on the whole budget? Of course, it's the Pentagon.
Yeah.
And with, under the Pentagon umbrella, you have billions, hundreds of billions, in fact, black budget programs and money allocated just for just about everything, including regime change and destabilizing countries, and also lots of military boondoggle projects, surveillance, satellite, Star Wars type projects, and new weaponry and so forth. So, you know, these are all a collection, a collective, if you will, of military contractors, and these are some big players. Okay, these are people like General Electric, people like Raytheon, Westinghouse, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman. You know, these also are the same companies that own and this is not an exaggeration, this is a fact, sit on the board and in fact own some of the major mainstream media outlets in the United States. So keeping the U.S. and keeping the West in this idea of a permanent state of war is not an agenda. It's an absolute reality, and it's constant. And so that's why the media will always back Washington policies. And Washington policies come from those corporate contractors. So Philip Hammond, the UK defense secretary, was spewing out this morning that, you know, Russia shouldn't underestimate Britain's resolve, military resolve, and that we will step up to the plate. And we need more defense spending. Of course, they've deployed a few Typhoons over to Poland to police the Baltic region. I mean, as if Britain has any military might at all. It's kind of a joke when you look at it on paper. It's just, you know, vestigial sort of status.
Right.
And of course, they're a member of NATO. NATO is a collective. And so you look at this and you think, I said early on that this is going to basically cool down. It's going to cool down after April. Because after April, when the Pentagon and that budget gets secured, which will hopefully be as large or larger than the year before, rather than being cut 25%. And that's what matters in America. What matters is getting that money from the taxpayer, cycling it through Washington, and then back to those corporations. That's what matters. That's what dictates the political agenda in America, and this also highly integrated with their relationship with Israel, okay? And to keep us in a permanent state of war in the Middle East, that's one of the reasons why, in my opinion, Israel exists. And Israel has such a strong hold over U.S. foreign policy and the financial campaigns of every congressman, senator, and every White House.
Yeah.
It really comes down to that kind of mutual benefit that all these corporations have with the sort of war footing. Now, what are you seeing? Well, you look at the think tanks, and there's quite a few of them. One of them is the Center for International Strategic Studies. And you just go into the documents from last year and the year before, and you read they have basically promoting this policy of Russia-phobia. In other words, neo-containment of Russia. Now, neo-containment isn't military containment, but it's basically keeping Russia's influence politically on the regional stage and on the world stage in check. And the reason is because if they can do that, then they can basically beat the doors down to allow Western corporations access to markets and also the banks in the West, the central banking syndicate, to have access to countries to be able to dump quite a lot of debt on those countries. And in exchange for that debt, they'll take collateral. And in the case of the Ukraine, that's becoming very clear this week. That collateral is the one to open up the Ukraine for sale, any of its state assets under IMF regulations, austerity regulations, to be able to, they would have to sell off all their state infrastructure and any nationalized companies that exist, anything that they can get their hands on. Foreign corporations to come in and buy it. And that was the exact words of Victoria Nuland back in December.
Mm-hmm.
She said that we need to make the Ukraine open for much needed international investment. Mm-hmm. Now, this it wasn't articulated very well to the Ukrainian people, if at all. And already you have this sort of government in the Ukraine right now, this self-appointed government that really took power by force, and your listeners know all about that, but they haven't negotiated at all with the IMF. They just said, right, we'll take the money and do as you like. So it'll first be $18 billion in what they call assistance, which is quite an interesting word from the IMF, assistance, but it has a lot of strings attached. Now, you contrast that with the deal that Russia offered the Ukraine before all this started, that was basically a no strings attached deal, $15 billion buying up Ukrainian bonds will raise the value of their currency, and that will help them to pay off some of the huge debt that they have to Gazprom and to Russia and for unpaid gas and stolen gas, which has been siphoned off since early 90s. But it was a win-win situation for the Ukraine and for Russia. But the minute that happened, and the minute that President Yanukovych backed out of a previous deal he was talking with the EU, which was a trade deal, turns out it was a very bad deal. And then Russia comes along and says, hey, we're going to offer you this deal, much better deal. And he said, well, it is a much better deal. I'm going to go for that. And then that's when the flash mobs were deployed in Kiev back in late November and December. And that's when we got to where we are today. So if you really look at the timeline and you look at what's come out, it's, to me, it's a no-brainer. But we've been absolutely hit with a tidal wave of propaganda in the West that quite a lot of people are not equipped to deal with.
Yeah.
Just because it's just all encompassing. We live in a giant echo chamber in the West, and people tend to repeat things that they hear. There's a few important pieces in this, and one of them was the characterizing Russia as having anti-gay laws.
Yep. That's a good one.
And because that's in the West, that's an easy soft spot you can hit. And people in a kind of neoliberal or, progressive liberal society where they really value women's rights and gay rights, just the idea, just floating that idea into the public discussion, which is immediately taken up in the echo chamber by politicians who don't read, who don't analyze anything.
Yep.
They literally just repeat. And people on the street then repeat. And you run into people now and saying, wow, the Russians, it's illegal to be a homosexual in Russia. And that's not actually even close to true.
Nope.
Okay.
True.
And then Pussy Riot, this band that was arrested and thrown in jail for something that, quite frankly, would be the equivalent of going into St. Peter's Cathedral or Westminster Abbey and desecrating that religious institution, and then videoing it, putting it on YouTube, even simulating what could be construed as sexual acts, will get you in prison in America if you did that in the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. And, of course, if you did that in Westminster Abbey, they would lock you up and perhaps throw away the key. But Russia can't touch them because then it just enrages liberals in the West that say, oh, how can they dare? You know, there's no freedom of speech in Russia. It's a ridiculous thing to try to even explain to people. But yet, this is what we deal with in the West. And for people to say that there's, you know, Russian propaganda, we'll get to that later, but we'll talk about the Ukraine now, but to insinuate that somehow there's no propaganda in the West or that it's not as bad as Russian propaganda. I have, you know, some news for people. When that's the Soviet Union disintegrated really in 1990, it's not around anymore. We're not talking about the Soviet Union over there. We're talking about Russia and another collection of sovereign states. So, but what they're doing is rekindling up this narrative, because these are powerful talking points that people can latch on to partially historically, and then they feel like they've got traction on some kind of perspective of history, and then they go and repeat whatever they see Stephen Fry tweeting or these other celebrities that were on Twitter who were really telling lies about Russia. But that's to create Russiaphobia, and again, straight out of think tanks, like the Center for Strategic International Studies in Washington, D.C. And here we go. We see it just moving forward. So, the thing that the real tragedy in all this is that you couldn't have had a more obvious sort of hands in the cookie jar moment with the two leaked phone calls. The first being Victoria Nuland speaking mm-hmm. to the U.S. ambassador,
yep.
and to hear the crassness in their voice as if they're talking about their Facebook friends, you know, Yachts and Klitsch and, Klitsch is the complicated electron and all this. And she's like, well, no, he can't be in government. We've got to keep him 2 hours a day. He's got to be hanging out with Yachts, talking to Yachts, and then we'll move him into government later. But we need to get, and this person needs to be in that position. And then for the Washington State Department people to come out and to tell the public that in a public press briefing, they sent one of their female I would say lackeys, I can't think of a better word, but to say, oh, well, that's just what diplomats do. They talk about these things. They weren't trying to engineer the government or anything. And so we have a level of deception, a level of lying, and a detachment from reality in the West of these political leaders and appointed people below them who aren't even elected, who really have control the levers of power, not the elected officials, and complete detachment from any of the interests of any American, from any of the interests of any Briton or any European, other than those who work for a handful of transnational corporations, mainly in the energy sector, the banking sector, and the defense sector, and the agricultural, the big agri sector. Okay. It's in their interests what's going on with regards to the toppling of the government in Kiev. It's not in the interests of any of the general populace. So there's no representation there. There's a disconnect there. And to me, it's a destructive situation. And if it's allowed to continue at its present clip, there's going to be huge problems, not just over there, as they say, but huge problems at home as well, because I do think there's quite a few people that are seeing that this has absolutely no relationship to their day-to-day lives at all.
There's a number of points here already, of course, what you brought up that I want to try to highlight a little bit more, and we'll get to Crimea specifically later, the divide that has occurred. You know, we'll need to talk a little bit about some of the background there as well in terms of the Russian connection to Crimea, but what would you say is the overall value, though, of the disinformation campaigns that we've been seeing going back and forth like this? I mean, if there is a bigger picture here with huge international corporations or transnational corporations in energy, banking, defense, and big agro, as you said, why do they need the support of the people behind them and rallying up this if this is not going to lead to a bigger conflict that needs to be ultimately sanctioned by the people in the West?
If you look at it like a chessboard, as a very, very blunt metaphor, you look at it as like a chessboard. The people are the pawns. So when you play chess, your first moves are usually made with the smaller pieces or the pieces that have limited moves. And of course, the pawns have the most limited moves of all the pieces, but the pawns are the front line. So in the case of what was happening in Kiev, the flash mobs that are really clearly directed, in some cases funded, by foreign interests. They're moved into position in order to create a bit of chaos on the street. And from there, that kind of softens up the place a little bit so that they can move in with a little bit bigger set pieces. And once that chaos and once that instability was sort of simmering, then we know from the second leak phone call that there were paid or snipers who were shooting police and protesters. And of course, that is this catalyst. That's what collapsed the truce agreement between the Yanukovych government and the right sector dominated rebellion, let's say.
Svoboda,
yeah. Right sector groups with very, very heavy neo-Nazi, neo-fascist flavor, I might add.
What do you make of that anyway? I mean, there's that idea that there's a number of nationalists, Nazis, people have called them, that seek to get in control in Ukraine at that point. Are they just opportunists, or are they being used in the bigger picture? Because if we do look, just as you said before, Patrick, who really is behind the previous revolutions in terms of the Orange Revolution and people who've been putting in money into funding these instability revolutionary things, they're far from Nazis, if we can put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, that truce agreement that was reached, that all parties were there, except for, I think the U.S. was not present, but the EU was present. All the major leaderships were there. And it was agreed the U.S. and the EU had no intention of letting that stand. That was just a formality. They knew they were going to shatter it. And what they do, what the State Department, what the CIA, what a lot of these foreign intelligence agencies and think tanks do is they want to identify in any country, whether it be Libya, pre-toppling of Gaddafi, whether it be Syria, whether it be Georgia, whether it be Turkey, or in this case, the Ukraine. They look for a crack. And when they see a crack and they identify a crack, they basically start hammering.
Right.
They throw money at it first, whatever that crack is, which will be some disgruntled people within the current government who they will need as key people in order to make this shift and make this regime change happen. They look at that and then they start hammering. And after they throw money at it, then the bullets start coming. And those bullets, in the case of Syria, we had an identical situation about 2 years ago in Homs, where snipers were reported shooting police and protesters. And that was the flashpoint for the Syrian conflict that turned the tide of public opinion, and it got this inertia started for the U.S. to start talking up the opposition
right.
and how they should support it. This is before the Al-Qaeda and the jihadists arrived in big numbers. And we saw this. We see the same thing in the Ukraine. We saw all of a sudden snipers appear and people start getting shot on both sides. One side blames the other. And of course, the West will always take the side of whoever they think is going to be the one they'll be partnering with in the months to come. But they don't care who they will get into bed with. If they have to get into bed with neo-fascists, neo-Nazis, the worst possible element in the Ukraine, who now dominates the thinking of the current unelected government, they'll do it. If they have to get into bed with rabid jihadists in Syria who are being shipped in from Libya, they'll help them ship them in from Libya. They'll ship them in from Egypt, Tunisia in big numbers. They'll ship them in from Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Pakistan, whatever. They don't care because in their eyes, they think, well, we'll make a deal with the devil here. And then we'll be able to sort of push the devil off to the side when
exactly.
we're done.
Yeah.
And we'll promise them a seat at the table in the new Libya, or we'll promise to seat them at the table at the new Syria, or in the case of the Ukraine, they think they have people in power right now in Kiev think they have a permanent seat at the table. But I'm sorry to say that's not the case. The West can mount a counter-revolution against this current government as and when they decide that they choose to. Whether that's successful or not is another question. But that's basically marriages of convenience, allowing people to immigrate to Syria, to go fight for the opposition, turning a blind eye. They can track them if they want. British intelligence services could track all of these people going to Syria for jihad tourism and coming back. And I'm not going to speculate whether or not they are actually working in the capacity of agents for the foreign office or whatever. I'm not going to say that that's the case because I don't know. But I do know that they can keep track of these people. And they know a lot more than they would let on to the public. Because what it does is they'll turn a blind eye to this for 2 or 3 years because it suits whatever policy they have going at that time. And then they'll change gears when that policy seems to have run its course.
Yeah.
So there's no transparency there. There's no accountability there. It is absolute, running roughshod over every single law in the books internationally and everything else. And that's how it's done. And for politicians to grandstand and lecture to the public about what they think is the right thing, and we should intervene, and we need to be strong and confront this country militarily or confront Russia, which is kind of a laughing joke, really, if you think about that. There's no way that Britain or the United States will follow through with any military threat other than trying to basically position some missile batteries in a new NATO country like the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not firing missiles, that's pushing missiles. And every single one of those missile batteries and all the engineering and support staff costs money. That's a contract.
Yep.
It's just, you have to look at military aggression and expansion as a series of contracts. Now, in a case of a country that can't fight back, which has been the norm really since in post-World War II, is attacking countries that don't have a viable national defense.
Sure.
That could be a war. Vietnam, they got more than they bargained for, obviously, and it dragged out. But while it dragged out, a lot of money was made. So they thought, well, that's fine. We'll sacrifice a million Vietnamese and 50,000 young U.S. men. And that's a fine price to pay for the money we're making. But in the case of Iraq and Afghanistan, no, we need the casualties to be a lot lower, and the civilian casualties will be high. But that's okay. That's a price we have to pay, and we'll sell that back to the people as we're protecting your freedom and democracy at home. And we know that story quite well. After the last decade, everybody has understood that, and that has made the public become a lot more cynical. And hence, they didn't get the green light in Syria back in late August. The door shut on that. And that was, that was a huge moment in history, because you could see the paradigm shifting. We talked about it. I don't know if we talked about it on this show at the time, but I talked about it with a lot of people. You could visibly see a shift going on. And that basically shift was the public turning away from the political leadership. And the political leadership, whatever they had been able to get their way in almost every case in history, and they didn't get it for the first time. Yeah. And that was significant. And I think that sent shockwaves, especially through the British establishment and massively through the U.S. establishment,
mm-hmm.
Because the U.S. needed Britain to vote for military intervention for them to get a fait accompli. And that was the same in Iraq. And that's why so much pressure was put on Blair and his government to ram through on the 11th hour with the Attorney General, with Lord Goldsmith, a legal justification for war, because they knew they were doing the wrong thing, but they had to do it. And why, I won't tell you why they had to do it or what threats were made or how these people are owned and bought and paid for, mm-hmm. to that degree that they would have to ram through a war based on completely, you know, phantasmal intelligence,
yep.
you know, fairy tale stuff that we know is to be the case looking back. And here's the one thing that I just can't ever get my head around is when you talk to any major editor, whether they be for the BBC or the head of ITV said after, I think it was after Iraq, years later, he was questioned. He said that, you know, only when looking back in hindsight can you write a definitive history about what happened. In other words, like, it's not our fault. You know, we didn't know it at the time.
Right.
And that excuse is what they all use. And I'm going to say that is a completely retarded reply. Because they can, for instance, I think he was talking about the Gaza flotilla when the Israeli commandos attacked the aid flotilla, which mm-hmm. was going from Turkey to Gaza.
Right.
I know some people who were aboard that and have told me exactly what happened. Okay. But ITV took tape, and so did the BBC, which was provided to them from the Israeli government. It was doctored, even put their own captions in it. And they went and they aired it. It was completely a one-sided Israeli account of events. And they said that, well, we didn't know at the time. Well, that's not good enough. If I was in charge and someone, and I was covering that event, if I was really, really doing fair reporting, I would look at the Israeli person handing me that version of events and I can say, right, I see where your interest is here and how you want to tell the story. So I'm not going to accept this.
Right.
I want to go find another tape, or I will play this and I will say that it's been doctored.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so to plead ignorance on the day is really astonishing. The arrogance, I won't say they're stupid, because they're not stupid. They know exactly what they're doing. they're playing innocent and they're doing the political thing, which is like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know. They always have that out. But that's not good enough.
No.
And that's why the more people become informed and the amount of people who are getting the news from alternative media are looking at the mainstream media more and more in droves every week and saying, that's not good enough. You guys are willfully deceiving the public. We're going to tune out. And I'm not buying any of those products being advertised on your TV because you're not giving us the truth. You give us the truth, we'll tune in. And more, I think people are going down that direction.
Yeah, they're dropping off, certainly. It's a very important point you made earlier there as well. I want to reemphasize that again, that they use anyone they can, you know, any group, any political party or ideology to get them excited as they will, you know, somehow get a spot on the ruling seat of government. But then, of course, you know, turn on them. We've seen that through so many different revolutions. Just think back of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, for example. You know, the guard that was there right with you, those are the first guys to go after you've gotten and maintained control, you know. So this is the same kind of idea here, basically. But who would you say is behind, if we look at something like the color revolutions, and specifically the one in Ukraine then, I think since 2001, Alexander Goldfarb, he's a microbiologist as well, on top of that, by the way, but a kind of an activist, whatever. Since 2001, he has been the executive director of the New York-based International Foundation for Civil Liberties, and that was founded and financed together with the now dead Russian oligarch Boris Berezovsky. And the foundation has, you know, distributed grants among NGOs both in Russia and Ukraine, Latvia, and I think they spent nearly $40 million U.S. dollars supporting the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. And again, if you watch Russian Godfathers, they basically walk out to the square there in Kiev and stand at some point to look at what we did, you know, just with balloons and a band kind of right there on the square of how, you know, how they could do this. In this scenario of what happened now most recently, is there any trace of this kind of activity as well? The same people, perhaps? As I said, Berezovsky is not there anymore, but Goldfarb certainly is. This is, of course, a George Soros connection here as well to the International Foundation for Civil Liberties. Any such trace in this case?
Well, it is Alexander Goldfarb. He wouldn't be any relation to Michael Goldfarb, the Washington Israeli-linked PR consultant, would he?
I will have to look at that, actually.
Look into that, because yeah. Basically Michael Goldfarb was working on the sort of as a PR consultant to Saakashvili in the run-up to that August 8th, 2008. Incredible media, you know, incredible media spin exhibit of all time, which was they managed to basically reverse the truth and then basically broadcast that out to the West immediately, saying that Russia had attacked Georgia, and that went on for a number of days and weeks, when in fact the opposite was true. Georgia attacked South Ossetia, where Russian peacekeepers were, and Michael Goldfarb, this PR consultant, I believe, in my opinion, is one of the masterminds behind this. And he also is linked to Eli Lake from The Daily Beast and Rosie Gray from BuzzFeed, who helped to basically promote Liz Waugh's dramatic on-air resignation from RT, which we'll talk about later.
Oh, certainly. So yeah.
Michael Goldfarb, that PR consultant, is there. But that was a huge public relations job, really, to basically deceive the public. But before that, with the orange, with the color revolution in Georgia, that was absolutely a National Endowment for Democracy, which is funded by the U.S. State Department, and many of these other what we would call pro-democracy NGOs are working, really being directed from behind the scenes by the U.S. State Department and working with elements of the CIA on the ground. And to basically create these flash mobs and to create the illusion that this somehow is an organic event, this is somehow a grassroots event. And of course, once these things pick up steam, these color revolutions, as we saw in the Arab Spring, they do take on a life of their own. In the case of Egypt, they couldn't, in the second wave of the Egyptian Spring, the West could not control it, because actually other outside parties outside of Egypt were already basically kickstarting that second color revolution and helping that. And it grew to such a degree. And then the Muslim Brotherhood were ousted from power. And we have what we have today. This is a business. The regime change business is an industry now. And one of the first progenitors of this business was a Yugoslavian, or say Serbian, organization, which was really started by some students during the Balkans War, and just after the Balkans War, to basically oust Slobodan Milosevic. And they were called OPTOR, OPTOR, O-P-T-O-R. And OPTOR was really getting the backing, the direction, the finance, and the backing from America to help oust the Milosevic regime and to discredit them publicly and to create one of the first color revolutions there. They became so good and so adept in how they organized that they had developed a template. So then OPTOR became Canvas. And Canvas is an international, really color revolution consultancy. And they trained members of the Tunisian student activist groups in advance of the Tunisian Arab Spring, and to take them off for training in places like Europe or even to Washington, to America, and then send them back again. So what they teach them basically is how to do, you know, the marketing, the leaflets, the signs in English, how to organize via social media, and how to develop the flows of information on Twitter and Facebook. And so the color revolution happens virtually, and then the virtual becomes physical. And then there it is on the street, becomes a flash mob. And then there's other bits of help coming in from the side. You can pay people to be out there. You know, $40 or $50 a day is sufficient in most countries, and that money will be supplied from outside. But that's what these NGOs do, is they prep the ground for in any country that they choose to target, and they can plan up to 5 or 6 years in the making, and they just need to get some traction. And once that traction's achieved, then the inertia begins, and then it's a case of trying to basically herd cattle. You know, herd cattle across the plain, and then you need some of the, you know, obviously heavier assets to do that. But to get it started online is relatively easy.
It is, exactly. And what do we even know about profiles or the way that they've now managed to run algorithms on how the social networks actually are connected? So if you basically manage to, shall we say, convince the right people in the right spots that have the strategic node points of the, you know, network, basically, and you can manage to get the support of those people, it might be fairly simple from there as well. And I just wanted to mention a side note as well, by the way, since we do touch upon symbolism now and then, but the OPTOR claims themselves that actually used their fist as their symbol of the movement.
Yes,
was actually taken
fist.
From the hand of Sauron, you know, the character out of Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
And that's the sign of the mass of orcs, you know. It's just very interesting, you know. Wow.
Yeah, and you know, it's you contrast that with what we saw in the Crimea, and what you saw in the Crimea was a complete opposite of the kind of stoked from outside color revolution, the artificial faux grassroots pseudo movement that makes, you know, great media material for people in the West. What people in the West didn't see in Kiev was that they had huge barricades built around right on the front line there. Everyone saw that, but they didn't see that they had left gaps in the barricades, because that protest took place in the most expensive shopping district in Kiev. So all the high-end designer boutiques remained open the whole time, and they made gaps so that the customers could walk through and get in and out of the shops without any problems, and that the latte, the Starbucks, and everything was okay, and people were going in there getting their coffees.
Yep.
They didn't show that on TV. What they showed you was a really narrow, very narrow shot of what was going on, to think that the whole city was in carnage and that something needs to be done.
Exactly.
And this just This just can't stand anymore. And it really provides the sort of padding that we require, our politicians require in the West to stand on that drama and really perform on stage when they're doing their heartstring speeches about freedom and democracy and the will of the people and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. But now, what about a bit more about Crimea here? There, obviously, they have a interesting history overall, but just also the past relationship with Russia and the fact that, as far as I've managed to gather it so far, is that there wasn't really an invasion of Russian troops into Crimea. There were already a lot of Russian troops positioned on that specific spot, not only because of the fact that they've had a long history there, but I think it's one of the only non-iced ports as well for Russia to actually get out, into the territory of the ocean there, as opposed to just doing it up north where half of the year that's going to be ice covered, right? So they've had bases in that region for a long time, and that's why we saw just such an immense, these troops are just popping up on the scene right there. And how would you break down that then? I mean, what is going to happen in Crimea now? They've had most recently ramping up to do have some kind of election there, I believe, in a couple of days or, so how do you interpret this?
Well, firstly, that Russia's had a presence in Crimea, and for those who don't know their geography, or hopefully we'll get on Google now and have a look if they don't know, but Crimea is the southern peninsula, which is almost an island, but it's hanging off the bottom of the Ukraine mainland. And I actually said on another show back in, I believe it was January, that that Ukraine will be broken up shortly and Crimea will be one of the breakup points, and simply because Russia has had a presence there since Catherine the Great. But that is Russia proper, Crimea.
Yeah.
It's mainly Russian-speaking. There's a number of dual residents there. But not just that. It used to be part of Russia, and it was given over to the Ukraine, which was a part of the Soviet Union, but it was done for political reasons by Nikita Khrushchev. And that process really took place in the late 50s and finalized in the early 60s. And that was seen by a number of people as a mistake at the time. And when the Crimean referendum took place a few weeks ago, it was a landslide. We saw the news a couple weeks ago, 90-something percent voted in favor of their independence as a sovereign state, part of the Russian Federation. So they still have the sovereignty, but obviously they're falling into the under the Russian umbrella. Mm-hmm. Now, Mikhail Gorbachev, who in anyone's book is an arch globalist, okay?
Yep,
he's a darling of Davos. He's friends with Brad Pitt and everybody else and Bill Gates. You can't get any more globalist from a Russian standpoint than Mikhail Gorbachev. He came out immediately and said this was a great achievement by the Crimean people. He said they corrected a mistake that was made many years ago under Soviet rule that should never have happened. That should be an indication to anybody, including President Obama and David Cameron and anyone else who's made a meal out of this, that is not a bad thing for the Crimean people. But what it was it was egg on the face for the West, because here they've initiated a destabilization campaign and a regime change operation in the Ukraine, and Vladimir Putin took his bishop and basically put it right there on their queen and immediately took him out with one move, checkmate. Mm. And so he said, okay, you want to put neo-Nazi fascists in power in Kiev and also rip, basically screw us out of a couple of $1 billion that they already owe us and basically shatter any trade deals we have with Ukraine. Okay, we're going to now we're just going to take the safety off for the Crimean people. We're going to let them vote in a referendum. They did. They voted. And of course, you hear the cries and the crying and the whining from West saying, oh, it's an illegal election and it's against the Ukrainian constitution. And how dare they? Well, let's just say this. The Ukrainian constitution ceased to exist the minute the current sitting government stormed the government buildings and took power by the barrel of a gun.
Yeah, that's right.
That's not in the Ukrainian constitution. So let's be grown up about this. I say to my friends in Washington and Brussels, there is no Ukrainian constitution the minute that armed coup took place. Okay,
I should say the still acting one. He's continued to stress that it's an illegitimate government in place. I'm still in charge. You know, we're going to throw them out, right? That's his position all along in this.
Yeah, well, that's his position, sure, and that's part of part of the plan. But the fact of the matter is, you can't keep Russia's influence out of the region. You can't even keep their influence out of the Ukraine, and not least of all the Crimea. They've had a presence there since Catherine the Great. The Black Sea Naval Fleet has been there since 1783. Okay, that's around the time the United States was founded.
That's right.
Okay, yep. And part of the treaty agreement and part of that agreement is that they had with the Ukraine, which has not been a long agreement, only about 40 years, was that they could station a certain amount of troops there. So they already had under their allotment, I think there have been something like 17,000 troops there. They're allowed to have 26,000. Plus they have other stations around in places around the Crimea. So to say that Russia invaded the Crimea is a total lie, and that is a lie that a lot of people in the West didn't question. They just absorbed it,
yep.
Just like they absorbed the same lie that Russia attacked Georgia in August 8th, 2008.
Mm-hmm.
That same lie, they just took it in. All the newscasters, they don't question anything. Whatever comes from the government press briefing, they just repeat it. They don't have any reporters over there, and if they do send people out, then they're basically spewing the party line.
Yeah.
But no facts involved, no truth involved in any of this. So this idea that Russia has invaded the Crimea has cascaded around the world at lightning speed, so fast even that it even caused one of RT's popular chat show hosts, Abby Martin, to do her own on-air protest saying that she doesn't condone military aggression on a sovereign state. So she even fell for the talking point.
Wow.
So, and she's quite bright. She's a pretty smart gal. But that shows you the power of propaganda and the pressure that puts. When that tidal wave of propaganda starts moving in the West, some people feel the weight of it. They feel the mass of it because they think that everybody is thinking the same thing.
Yep.
And all of a sudden fear sets in. And I saw this fear in the run-up to the Iraq war that a lot of people had. I saw it. I definitely saw it as the Syrian question came up to the 11th hour. And you can see basically who can see through this illusion and who is overtaken by the illusion by how they react and what they say. And so I knew from day one there was no weapons of mass destruction being used by the Syrian government in Ghouta. I knew that whole chemical weapons thing was staged because the evidence suggested so.
Right.
And I was just looking strictly at the evidence. I was looking at motive. I was looking at the historical profiles of the sort of people who, dabble in WMDs and also understanding false flags. And you can make a pretty educated assessment of what you're looking at there. And the same goes with what we saw in Kiev, who is behind it, which organizations, which institutions. And again, then when the propaganda starts kicking into high gear, you can't just go along with the echo chamber. You really have to step back and resist the pressure.
Absolutely.
To change the way that you think. And that's a very strong thing. And it's not an easy thing. You have to be very confident and secure about yourself.
Yeah.
And what your really core belief system is, and value system is to be able to weather that storm, because it's the power of illusions in terms of media and political newspeak is a significant, powerful thing for many people. And it's not something to be taken lightly en masse. But as an individual, it's actually very easy to see through it.
It is. You know, you're absolutely right. There's so much to it, but people just, they have to stay cool. You know, that's one of the criteria as well. It's so easy to get swept away, and every media channel all over the place is talking about it, including the alternative media. And it's just an onslaught of not only opinions, but also, as you said, very much is just moving in the same direction of that momentum that amasses itself. So, you know, take a deep breath, step back, think about it. And it's important to look at it from a historical point of view, because that's something that people always misses. They look at it from what has happened in the last 5 minutes, really, on the timeline, you know, and not really seeing the bigger picture. And I just see that so much all the time. And we make even moral value judgment, you know, with our current lens and don't think previous things into consideration and all that stuff. So there's huge problems with that. But Patrick, let's take a short break here, actually, and then we'll kind of pick up after the break here again and just continue basically to talk more about this. I want to get into a little bit more about the news anchor that quit. I want to ask you a little bit more about the 7:30 flight, what the hell is going on there. And then we have the BBC, of course, as well, and how they've been viewing the Syria situation there now most recently. So we have much more to discuss. But give us your website, Patrick, where people can follow you, where they can tune into the Sunday Wire, and if there's anything else you want to plug for our audience, Patrick.
Sure, yeah, go to 21stcenturywire.com and I'd just say big thank you to anybody who's really been coming and supporting the site and reading the articles and sharing them, because it's been great the last few months. And we've just started a weekly, what I call internet radio show and podcast, which is called The Sunday Wire. It's 3 hours of straight talk radio with a bit of music as well and some great guests. And it's slowly... you know, growing in numbers and viewers each week. So it's been great. I appreciate the support we're getting from people and having fun with it, especially the radio show. It's great.
Very good. 21stcenturywire.com. We'll have the links up. Thank you, Patrick. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Before Echo.